That is my favorite kind of introduction. Silence. How are you, gentlemen? Could we bring the lights up a little bit more? That'd be great. Thank you. Oh, man, it's good to be with you guys here every year. How many of you are back for the umpteenth time? How many of you have been at every retreat that you can remember? You made a way to be there. I'm glad you made your way to be here today, and I'm going to talk about David. And boy, when you talk about men of valor, he's a bedtime story for valor, isn't he? And we all know his story. We'll talk about that. I get two sessions with you, so if you don't like the first, you don't have to come back for the second. But we will hunt you down. We will find you. I want to ask you to turn in your Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 17. It's a fun weekend for me. I called my wife this morning when I had to drive out off campus for a bit. So she's in Colorado right now. She's up in Vail, Colorado. Wow. And she's in the season. Yesterday she flew out there, or actually Thursday she flew out there with our daughter Shannon. So the Welshes are all over the place right now. But Shannon's leading worship for a group of several hundred women up in Vail with, I think there's a handful of churches just like this, but I think mostly it's Calvary Aurora. And Joy is doing the teaching. And I thought, this is just great that, you know, I get to be here with the men, she's there with the women, my daughter's up there helping. And just this last week, I'm in the process of... I'm 66 years old. Okay, that's a process too. But I'm in the process of finally putting together a CD of some Christmas songs that I've been writing over. It actually goes back 20-something years, and I tell myself every January, I'm going to get these together. And finally, providentially, God put together a relationship with this guy that does this a lot, and he went to Israel with us on a trip, and he said, hey, I want to help you get these recorded. And so I'm in the process of that, but last, when was it? It must have been Wednesday. It was Wednesday, and... We were using a studio over at Calvary Costa Mesa. This guy that's doing the recording lives up in Apple Valley. So it's a little bit of a trek, but it's so beautiful and quiet up there in the upper desert. But we wanted to give the vocalist a break and not let them travel so far. Well, all the vocalists are my daughters, my three daughters. And then at the end of, you know, we were laying down these vocal tracks. There's this one part in one of the songs that I wrote. I wanted to do this as a nod to my dad. How many of you ever heard my dad sing? None of you ever heard my dad sing. He passed away in 1989. And it wasn't quite the story that John told last night about when his dad passed away. But I love my dad, love my dad. And it was my dad that gave me a heart for music. He had the most incredible voice I've ever heard, and I'm not the only one that thought that. Whenever there was a wedding or some reason to have somebody sing at a gathering, they called Vince. And Vince would come and just blow the doors off. He was the most incredible Irish tenor you've ever heard. And I remember as a little boy, we're standing in the snow outside Batavia, Ohio. How many of you have ever heard of Batavia, Ohio? All right. Really? No kidding. Just outside Cincinnati. So... we're standing in the snow there outside the Kroger. How many of you know what a Kroger's is? Yeah, Kroger Market. And they had a living nativity. It was either living or at least life size. I think it was living. And Dad was asked to come and do a couple of solos. And so I'm standing there maybe 5, 6 years old, and I'm holding his hand, and I'm looking up at this man who was my hero and my role model. And I hear him singing in Latin. Adeste fidelis nati. And I'm looking up at him thinking, that's my daddy. And so in a little nod to my dad in this one song, I didn't sing that whole song, but I put in just this verse. It goes, venite adoremus. Sing that with me. Venite adoremus. One more. Venite adoremus. Dominus. I want you all on the record, okay? But my daughter, what we did is we layered it just one at a time. We took him into the isolation booth, and I wanted them all to sing it together, but the sound engineer said, no, let's do them separately, because if there's any pitch issues, I can bring them up, but I can't do it if they're all together. So one by one, I got to hear my daughter Starlin go in. Actually, Bethany first, and she sang it beautifully. Starlin went in. She sang it beautifully. Shannon came in and killed it. And then my two granddaughters, my oldest granddaughters, Emmy and Mia, they came in. They go to school there at Costa Mesa. They came in, and I said, hey, girls, jump in the booth. And they're both great, great voices. And my goodness, they walked in there without any intimidation about that microphone and, you know, hand in one ear, just perfectly. And it just blew me away. But why am I telling you this? Oh, I know what I was going to say. It was just this rich moment. And my son came into the studio a little bit later. He's playing bass and some guitar parts on the record too. And I'm going to try to get his vocal, though he doesn't feel confident in that. But it was just this sense of, Lord, thank you for your hand on my house. Thank you for your hand on my tribe. And these kids, not just that they know how to sing, but they love you. And how many of you have kids? And how many of you have watched kids struggle with their faith? Any of you have kids struggle with their faith? Every one of my kids has done that. And but God's brought them through. And I just felt like here this weekend, Lord, and all this last week, getting to serve you with my family, sending my wife off to Colorado in the season between the autumn and the winter, when the snow was coming down while they were driving in the Vail, where the colors were on the trees. And it's just one of those moments that I'm just so thankful that just about 47 years ago, 48 years ago, this coming November, Jesus said, you're mine. And he picked me up out of a pit and he brought me to himself. Anybody else thankful for that moment in your life that he just said, you're mine, and he drew you to the place where you said yes? Well, I want to open our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 17. And Rob, thank you for being here with jet lag and everything. You're sitting in the back, and Joe's going to keep you awake. I know you got to be drifting in and out, and I have an amazing gift at ministering peace to people. So if you fall asleep, we'll understand. So, well, in 1 Samuel 17, who doesn't know this story? I'm just going to cut to the core of the story. And read the, you know, this passage that you all know so well. And it's so, so rich, where David is called to the forefront. And he goes out to deliver some groceries to his family. And so here in chapter 17, David shows up. And let me see, what verse do I want to start reading? Let's go to verse 17. Jesse, the father, says this. So 17:17, 1 Samuel. Then Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run, don't walk, run to your brothers at the camp, and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their thousands, and see how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them. And then Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting, although there wasn't much fight going on in the fight, was there? They're just watching and they're trembling. Going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army, lots of saber rattling and lots of shouting. And verse 22, and David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. Now, as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, they fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches and will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him. Oh, by the way, I'm sorry, we skipped what the giant was saying. He says, "Send me somebody to fight." Did that sound a little bit like Ken Graves? "Send me someone to fight. Just choose a man, send him out to me. I need a battle." And so he's taunting them. And he makes all of these promises. He says, "If you kill me, then we will serve you. Well, if I kill you, you won't be serving us, you'll be dead." He's just so confident. The old word was bombastic. He's so audacious. He's so loud and obnoxious. And so he says the same thing again. In verse 26, David shows up. And David says this, "Then David spoke to the man who stood by him, saying, What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine?" Let's go again. Go ahead, David, get biological on us if you want to. "But who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David and said, Why did you come down here? How many of you have older brothers? You ever have older brothers that kind of put you down and put you in your place? That's Eliab. Eliab, the oldest brother, heard him. He said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few measly sheep?" I put in measly. "Those sheep in the wilderness. I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now?" There's a backstory there. "You're always picking on me, Eliab. What is it now? What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" Oh, I love that. I remember hearing Pastor Dave Sylvester in York, England, preaching on this. "Is there not a cause?" The generation we live in, men, can I ask you, is there not a cause? Is there not a need for men of God to stand up and be men of God? And to not cower and not be afraid? Powerful message last night from John Wang. To stand up and not cower, not tremble, but to be men of valor. Is there not a cause? And then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. Can you picture this with David? He's repeating himself. "Come on, guys, isn't there a reason to stand and fight? There's a cause. Somebody rise up." He said the same thing, and these people answered him just as the first ones did. And now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail." I'm sorry. That wouldn't have been his voice. "Let no man's heart fail because of him. He's 15 years old," they say. Maybe his voice is broken before 15, but he's a kid. He's what, a sophomore in high school? He says, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." But David said, your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of his flock, I went out after it, and I struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. And your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. And you know what he just said? I've been warming up for this guy. I've been practicing for this guy. I've killed lions. I've killed bears. And did I mention he's uncircumcised? This uncircumcised Philistine who's not in covenant, that's all that meant. He's not in covenant with the living God. He's nothing. I do bears. I do lions. I do tigers. Oh my, I do them all. I do all the beasts. He said, "Bring him on." He says, and so David says, Again, where was I? Your servant has killed them all, and this guy is defying the army of the living God. Verse 37, moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, well, go, and the Lord be with you. What an easy thing for this cowardly king to say. Oh, God bless you, son, go get him. And sends him off, probably thinking, to his death. So Saul clothed, and you know the story, Saul clothed him. Does anybody know the rest of the story? The rest of the story is probably what you told your children when you were putting them to bed when they were little. You probably left out the uncircumcised part because you didn't want to explain that right before bedtime, right? But you went right to the battle and you told them about this 15-year-old boy who said, that's no big deal. That big man is no big deal. And you told them about the fact that it was... Where did I put my sling? I brought a sling here. Oh, no, I've lost my sling. I actually did. I brought a sling with me. Well, I lose things all the time. But this sling, it's all he had. Two strings and a little pouch of leather, or maybe some textiles that he'd put together, and that's all he ran in with. Five smooth stones. Why five smooth stones? Many of you know the reason why. Because Goliath had brothers. And he goes out and he brings down the giant. One smack to the head, and then he chops off the head just to make sure that the snake is dead. Don't you do that when you kill a snake? You chop off the head just to make sure that it's dead. And it's an amazing story. Everyone knows the story. It's a powerful story of faith and valor. Everyone, I think one of the reasons we love this story is that everyone loves to watch a good fight. How many of you have ever watched a pay-per-view fight? See, I knew there'd be some. How many of you are afraid to admit it? Raise your hand if you don't want to admit it that you have. See, everyone loves a fight, or they love to watch a fire. And I don't know why that is. We love to gather around for disasters, watch somebody get nearly beat to death, or watch a fire, watch a building burn down. Everyone loves a fight. I'm looking forward to, hopefully, the Bengals rising from the ashes of the Steeler defeat. I'm from Cincinnati. Rising from those ashes and taking down the Chiefs this weekend. That will be a tough fight. But it takes a fight to identify a man or a woman of valor. All the training in the world is important. But there comes a day when you step on the field. There comes a day when you go to the front line. There comes a day when you face the giant. And then we find out if there's a man of valor there. By the way, men of valor don't always win. Sometimes men of valor die in battle. And we have buried many, many, many men and women of valor in the history of our great nation. But we've been looking at men of valor, and it's important to remember that it takes a fight to identify a man or a woman of valor. Everyone sees that UFC moment. In the ring or on the field, there's they're wrestling there on the mat, but very few people see the training, the backstory behind the story. They don't see the sweat. Do any of you follow on social media Jocko Willink? Does anybody know about Jocko Willink? Not just one Jocko Willink fan. Are you a fan of him? I'm really beginning to be a fan of this guy. You should look him up. He's written a few books on discipline. And on his Instagram feed, he likes to, the first thing he'll post, and he usually posts three things in a day. First thing, he shows you his watch, a picture of his watch. It's 4:30 in the morning. He wants you to know he's in the gym at 4:30 a.m. in the morning. And then the next thing he shows you is the weights or the apparatus that he's working on. And it's usually some sort of weights or those bell weights. Yeah, kettlebells. And then the last thing he shows you, and it took me a while to realize what it was, it's just a picture of where he's been working out, and it's a puddle of sweat. He just wants you to know, I came and I worked hard. Why? Because I'm preparing for battle. He was a Navy SEAL. Still, I guess you would say he's a Navy SEAL and a trainer of SEALs. But just a powerful voice for discipline. When he insists, if you're going to get in shape, if you're going to get your discipline together, you got to get up early and go work out. And invariably he has these questions. Somebody says, well, how do you get up and get to the gym at 4:30 in the morning? He says, you set your alarm and you get up. That's how you do. You set your alarm and you get up. That's true. The discipline that comes before the fight The discipline that comes before the day of the battle is always hard. And very, very few people see that. Before the battle becomes, before the battle comes your way, there is that season of training and building. Say it with me. Before the battle comes the building. And you got to build that character into yourself, obviously by the hand of God. But something prepares us to stand and to hold our ground and to fight. And then either to win or to die trying. To say, I will stand in this battle. David was defined as a leader and a valiant warrior, in that Goliath moment. But there was a backstory to that. That Goliath moment, it was a throwdown like we've read. It was this confrontation, this giant that just kept calling out day after day after day to this nation, calling for someone, give me a challenge, send me a man. Just send me a man that we may fight, and then the winner takes all. And not a man of Judah budged. Not even the king. You know, and by the way, not even Jonathan. He was there. Nobody budged. None of David's big brothers, all six of them, not a one of them budged. They all just trembled and they cowered on their mountain. Do you remember how the scene was set up? The Philistines were on their mountain and the Jews were on their mountain. And in the middle of the mountain, between the mountains, was a place called the Valley of Elah. The Valley of Elah. And the taunt is going out, and the men are there trembling. And then here comes David with his grain and cheese. Doesn't that sound like the fixins for pizza? He's bringing them cheese pizza. And dad says, go find out how they are and take them some food and some special cheeses for the captain. And he arrives with his pizza, and David, the valiant, has arrived. We read some defining or definition of the word valor last night. Looked up valiant. And here's what it reads from just about any online dictionary. Valiant means possessing or showing courage. And I love this, or determination. Here's the sentence. I love how they always put it in a sentence. Valiant. I don't know why they chose a woman for the definition of valiant. Maybe they knew my wife. That could be it. Then here's a sentence. She made a valiant effort to hold her anger in check. I wonder how many of our wives have made a valiant effort to hold their anger that we've given them cause for in check. Here's the synonyms. Brave and courageous, intrepid, heroic and gallant, lion-hearted, bold, fearless, daring, unflinching, unshrinking, unafraid. I'm not sure that's true, like John said last night. I think fear is a part of the mix that valor rises out of. Unafraid and tough, indomitable, stout-hearted. I love these last ones. Spirited and plucky, gutsy, spunky, and audacious. Most of that sounds like a three-year-old, doesn't it? You know, before they've been disciplined, just spunky and audacious. And there is something about the valor in my little four-year-old grandson. Nothing makes him afraid. He'll just jump right off the counter between a stone fireplace and a hardwood coffee table, and he doesn't care. He's unafraid. He'll probably learn some wisdom, but I hope he doesn't lose his courage. That little boy has valiance, I think, written all over him. But it happens. I agree with John from last night. Does he remind anybody else of Yoda but me? He's just such a wise-looking guy. I love listening to him. But valor involves the reality of dealing with fear. You have to deal with fear. We all have fears. It's not the absence of fear. And valor rises when we're thrown into a crisis. If the makings of it are there. If the training has taken place. I love JT. Anybody else love JT? You have no idea who JT is, do you? No, not Justin Turner, not Justin Timberlake, James Taylor. Come on, James. Anybody like James Taylor but me? Okay, probably most people in my generation. But I've been listening to a bit of his stuff recently, and there's this one cut on his record that I think the name was Before the Worlds Began, and it's called Far Afghanistan. Listen to this verse. It says, they tell of a tradition in the hills of Kandahar. They say young boys are taken to the wilderness out there, taken to the mountains alone and in the night. And if he makes it home alive, they teach him how to fight. It's the challenging of a young soul. I think David had a lot of that challenging of his young soul. There were nights where he was out there, and he tells us he's out in the field tending the sheep, and lions and bears come along. There was a threat, and he stood. We all know David's story. Every seven-year-old knows a story about David killing Goliath, but every mighty man and every mighty woman of valor has a backstory that involves preparation. And can I just give you the bullet points on this? We're not going to turn back to all of these passages. But if you look back just a little bit in the story of David, you see him as, most scholars think, anywhere from 10 years old to 12 years old is when Samuel shows up looking for a new king. And it's obvious that Jesse knows there's something on the line here. I don't know that he knows that it's the next king that's about to be anointed. But Samuel says, you got some boys here, I understand. And he brings them out one by one, by one, by one, by one, by one, another one. And Samuel sees Eliab and he says, now that looks like a king. And God says, that's not the one. You're looking at the wrong point. You're looking at the outside. I'm looking at the inside. He says, you got any more boys? So Eliab is not the one. Abinadab, he's not the one. Shema, he's not the one. And then number 4, 5, and 6, and 7. Was David 7 or 8? I think I lost count. But David is the one that's not in the pack. Do you have any more boys? Well, yeah, but you see out there on the hill? That little speck up on the hill with the sheep? That's my youngest son. He says, well, bring him because we're not going to have the sacrifice. We won't have the meal until you bring him. And as he walks towards Samuel, he says, that's the king. That's the king. Whom God has been preparing to be a man of valor. He says, that little guy, that's the one. And so he says, all right. And he pours the oil all over him. And Israel now has a new king. Youngest son of Jesse, stuck out in the field while dad and the brothers went with Samuel to the sacrifice. And there he was. He was just sort of discounted. He's just my last boy. And he's out there. And nobody thought much of him. Somewhere around age 12 to 14, Saul becomes the personal musician, court musician for Saul. Why? Because the Spirit of God had left Saul, descended upon David, and David was now the king. But it would be years, 15 to 20 years, before he would actually serve as the king. You know what he did almost all those years? He ran from Saul. All those years. And from the point that Saul, the Spirit of God had lifted from Saul, all Saul did once he met David and he'd sung for him for a while, when he went nuts, when he went crazy and that disturbing, distressing spirit came upon him, all he tried to do was kill David. There's one stunning passage to me in the whole story as it comes toward the end of David's life. It said, every day, think about this. What's on your mind when you get up in the morning? Whatever it is, when it was Saul, said every day he got up and thought, oh, what's on my agenda today? Oh, yeah, kill David. Every day, just find David and kill him. And so David spent all this time running, but he became Saul's personal JT, not Justin Timberlake, but James Taylor. He became his psalmist, and he had such a powerful anointing on him that when he played, the demon fled. You got to see this. I just want you to see this one part. Go back to chapter 16 if you got your Bible open. It said, so Saul, in verse 17, it says this. So Saul said to his servants, provide for me now a man who can play well, a musician, and bring him to me. And I love this. By this time in his life, listen to his testimony. He hasn't killed a giant yet. He's been in battle, but it says, one of his servants answered and said, look, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing and a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech. And by the way, he's a handsome kid. And he said, God's with that kid. God's with. By this time, he had established a reputation somehow, often in obscurity, that he knows how to do battle. He knows how to fight. He knows how to not turn back. He stands up in war. He stands up to beast. And man, he's a great musician. This guy's about, and he's good looking. He said, bring him. And so he comes and the demons flee when he plays. And then 15 years old, he shows up with the pizza. And while he's there, he fills in his resume. He said, oh, by the way, let me tell you what else I do, Saul. He said, I kill lions. I kill bears. I do it barehanded. I tend my sheep. I've been tending my father's flock. And he said, I'm pretty good with a sling, too. I'm pretty good with a sling. And so he gets the job. And we can fill in a little bit more that I think is huge in understanding what made David a mighty man of valor. If you look between the lines of the story of David, you don't have to look too far between the lines. You don't have to really make any of this up. But you find that the other parts of his profile are this. He spent a lot of time alone out in the field. I mean, you got a lot of time alone. What do you have time to do? You had time to think. What else did he have time to do? Practice what? Throwing a sling? Practice what else? His harp? Practice what else? Writing songs? Killing beasts? Defending his brother said, your little flock? Those few sheep were important to him. And I think that's huge. He said, I tend sheep, I kill lions, and I spend a lot of time alone. And as he's out there in the field, it was time to think and time to pray and I think time to dream. And like you said, Maynard, time to practice that sling and time to reflect and time to listen. One day, I don't know if he was a young man or an old man when he wrote this one, but one day out in the field, he says, God, you're my shepherd. I really have everything I need. I shall not want. You make me lie down in green pastures. You lead me beside still waters. See, that's the kind of shepherd he was for his sheep. He said, Lord, you. There was a moment, maybe one day, when he was just tending sheep, and something hit him. God, you do all this for me. And he writes he was not a one-hit wonder, but if he was, Psalm 23 would have been that one hit. Probably the most popular song in all of the world. It's been translated into almost every known language. And it's been written, and boy, if he gets royalties from that song in heaven, he doesn't need them anymore. But he writes a beautiful song. Another day, he's maybe laying on his back at night, and he's tending the sheep, and they're close by, and he's just looking up, and he says, wow, God, when I consider the heavens, it's the work of your hands. The sun and that moon that you've made. What am I that you even think about me? Some of you guys have had that thought. But maybe you've had the thought on the negative side of it, the flip side of the coin, like, God, I just don't believe you even think about me. Hey, here I am, God. Why have you forgotten me? David wrote something like that too. My God, where are you? But there was a night when it just so caught him by surprise to see all those stars. I used to love the years we spent out in the desert, and we spent a lot of years in the desert, but about 18 years out in the lower desert near Palm Springs, but most of it not in Palm Springs, out in a place called Sky Valley. And I have four children that I've mentioned, but I used to love that moment where I would take them out, and we just either sit on the back on the tailgate of the truck or maybe lay back and just look up at the stars. And I wouldn't say anything because I wanted to wait until they said something. What would they say? Wow. And they'd have that David moment when I look at the stars and the sun and the moon that you've made. It makes me feel small, and it does. And David writes these beautiful, beautiful psalms. The point of this, to me, brothers, is this, and I hope I can be very, very clear about this, that valor isn't something that starts when you come to the Valley of Elah. It's the backstory where it's built. You know where it started for David? In a sheep pen. Or out in the field following his sheep. We are training right now for the moment that just might be our definitive moment of valor. And you're in training. I'm in training right now for the battle that's coming my way. Got a lot of battles behind me, and so do you. But God's training me for maybe it's that Goliath moment. Or maybe it's the moment we're going to talk about in the next session. But it's a big moment, and God has you right now in training for that. And our response in in every one of those, in the face of every one of those opportunities to turn and run and just forget it and go back to something that's easier. Easier now, but it'll be far harder down the road. But if you choose the easy now, get ready for the hard much later. And sometimes not much later. You choose the easy road to pleasure. You choose the easy road to riches. Get ready, because payday's coming and you'll be paying. And so it's in the moments that we're in right now, we're training for a moment that really might be the definitive moment of our life. Something in your life will stand out above everything else in your life. You'll be known to somebody. And by the way, it might be different things to different people. But you might be known, and I pray to God that you are. You might be known to some people as, hey, that's the guy that killed the giant. That's the guy that learned how to slay the giant. It won't be spoken quite like that. It might be something more along the lines of, hey, that's the guy who loved his wife like nobody I've ever seen. Even when we knew they were having conflict. Hey, that's the man who forgave his wife. Hey, that's the man that I've watched raise godly boys and girls. He loves his boys and girls. He disciples his boys and girls. And every time I say that, I want to be very quick to say your discipleship of your children doesn't end when they leave the house. I'm writing this one song now. It's not finished, but it's got this feel in it that the house is empty because the kids have flown. Here's the lyric. The house is empty now. Because the kids have flown, or the house is quiet because the kids have flown, and now they think we're wise because they have kids of their own now. But it's that idea, you know, when it's just down to a tiny table will do now for Joy and I, because it's just down to the two, just like when it was just me and you, I say in the song to her. And I want these to be the sweet moments in life. And just as sweet as it was when all the kids were in the house. But your discipleship of your children doesn't stop when they leave the house or when they get married or when they have their kids, because you're still pops or you're still daddy. You're still father. Or if you're Irish, you're da. You're da to them. And you always will be. And you have such access to disciple your boys and girls. And if they won't listen to you, how many of you have had moments when your kids wouldn't listen to you? You can talk to God. He'll listen to you. And he'll accomplish things in them that you can't. Can I say this to you? Your prayer, your intercession for your children is the most important talk you will do on their behalf. Far more important than what you say to them is what you say for them or about them to God. Because God can touch them in places you can't touch them. And God can say things to them that they won't hear from you. And so turn God loose on them. And just pray over them. If they're little at home, pray over them while you got them there. I would sneak into their bedroom long after I knew they were asleep. And the ones who were light sleepers, I wouldn't touch them because I didn't want to wake them up. I didn't want them to catch me praying for them at that moment. But the ones who were sound sleepers, like Jeremy, gone as soon as he hit the pillow. I just lay my hand on his shoulder and just pray over his day and the mysteries of the day. I didn't know what he'd been through. I didn't know who had bullied him. I didn't know what people had said to him. I didn't know who had put him down. And I just prayed that God would touch him in places that I couldn't touch him and just fill him and strengthen him. But may you be known as the guy in that Goliath moment in your life, that when people are watching, you're the guy who was honest on the job and the guy who was kind to his neighbor. And sometimes you get the opportunity to tell him who deserves the credit for that. That it was Jesus who did that all. The day that you and I are in right now is the day of both battle and preparation for the next battle, just like David. And it might be the definitive battle of our life. And there before you, where God has called you to take a stand and to rise to fight, or maybe just to wait upon him, it is so powerful for what God wants to accomplish in your life in the next phase. There is a flock right there that you're responsible for. And I'm not just talking about your family, your wife, and your children. I'm talking about those circles of influence that we all have. Yes, the family, but the people in the classroom. There's teachers here. I know, there's teachers here. And there's all of us work in some sort of a team. And that's your circle of influence. And you get to touch those people's lives like nobody else can. It might be the t-ball team, the basketball team that you coach. And you get to touch them. Oh my goodness, this was I'd say it's 35, 37 years after the fact. I used to coach a t-ball team. I had no business coaching a baseball team. I barely played myself as a kid, but my kids played. And so I coached. And there were these two kids. There was Hutch and Brian. And Hutchison was their last name, but little Hutch, little William was known as Hutch. And Joy and I were out for our couples retreat in the desert. And we're watching the evening news. And I see this guy comes on the news, and he's a sergeant or a lieutenant of the police department in Palm Springs. And it says, Sergeant William Hutchison. I said, that looks like that could be him. And so I emailed the police department, and I said, hey, I think I might know that guy, and here's my number if he would call me. He called me back. And we got together for coffee before we left the desert that night. And I'm so proud of that young man. Family had fallen apart, sadly enough. His brother Brian, he says, he's so dangerous, we can't even have much contact with him. We cannot even let him know where we live. He'd gotten onto meth, and just his life had gone just berserk. But he's praying for him. And Hutch is a believer in Jesus. And what was so humbling to hear him say is, I've remembered you all these years. I wonder what happened to the Welsh family. He said, I'm so thankful that God put you in my life that when I was just a little boy. This is the age of my daughter, Shannon. And it was just, you have no idea who you're touching today. And what lion you're killing, or bear you're slaying, or what Goliath you're pulling down, either on your own behalf or for many, many others, just like David did. It's just those moments that are before us every single day that God has trusted you and I with a whole pack of people to influence them for him. That's your Goliath moment, brothers. And we all have it. It's a simple task. It's that circle of influence. We prepare in obscurity, and then we rise to fight battles. And sometimes that battle will be in the spotlight. Very rarely, but sometimes it'll be in the spotlight. We fight all those personal battles of our own, and we prepare for the moment that God's calling us to. And then sometimes there's that call to the spotlight to lead, to stand, and to resist the enemy on behalf of ourselves and behalf of other people. But let me say to you, beware of the spotlight. If God calls you to the spotlight, don't you dare steal the spotlight. Don't you dare steal the glory. Don't turn it into a show. Don't turn it into the Pastor Bill show or the whoever show. Make sure that when people leave, they're talking more about Jesus than they're talking about you and what you did and who you are. And that's our responsibility. He was called to serve. David was called to and raised up to serve in what seemed like, oh, I do this. This is easy for me. I play my little harp and I play my flute and I sing some songs. And wow, seems like demons even flee. And peace comes upon people in a very different way than peace comes upon people when I speak. But there's a waking up. And there's a powerful outpouring of the Spirit of God in times like that. So he's called to serve. And here he stands as a boy with a testimony. And people are saying, I've seen that son of Jesse. The brothers kind of were a little on the put down. Samuel saw Eliab and Abinadab. But David, God saw David. And he said, that's the one that I want to touch my people. That's the one, that little fifth grader, sixth grader, whatever age he was, tending his sheep and defending his daddy's flock. He's ready for something else. And he pulls him up. He was a mighty man of valor long before he killed the giant. He was a boy who knew how to seek God. He was a boy who knew how to take orders and just be obedient and just be faithful. He was a boy who learned to deal with disappointment. They should be stuck out in the field while the other boys had the dinner with the prophet. A boy who knew how to be still and to wait. And he's anointed king 15 to 20 years before he ever gets to sit on the throne. And there wasn't a whole lot of sitting on the throne. In fact, when David did too much sitting, that's when he got in trouble. He did well when he rose up and went to battle. And then here in our story today, this morning, he kills a giant. He just stands up. He says, all right, that's it. I got a sling. I got a stone. I'm killing a giant like you do, you know.